So I'm going to talk about our status of the NMR investigation of new ion planetary superconductors. Let's see, so it's very hard to find my... Can you hear me? Okay, so this is primarily a thesis work of my student who is now a postdoc with me, Fan Longmen. And we are collaborating with David Manders and Sina Sefa at Oak Ridge, and also Haifu Wen's group at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and Carver's group on ion selenide system. Oh, this doesn't like it. Okay. Oh, dear. So this is the phase diagram, more or less a generic phase diagram for all kind of things except for ion selenide. So basically, you have ion atoms forming square lattice, and each ion is surrounded by four arsenic atoms. And without any doping, typically, unless you apply strong pressure, they are spin density wave ordered, and it's generally a commensurate spin density wave. Now, if you dope, in this case, cobalt atoms, now the, what the cobalt atoms are doing here is itself a little controversial, but generally it is believed that if you dope cobalt into ion site, cobalt has one extra electron over ion, so you dope electrons into the lattice of ion scalars. Now, you can dope, instead of cobalt, for instance, a phosphorus atom into arsenic site, or if you can dope, you can dope, say, nickel atoms into cobalt site. So nickel has two extra electrons over iron, so it's actually twice more effective than cobalt in terms of driving spin density wave into superconducting phase. So in the case of cobalt, you need about 6 to 8% of doping into iron site to optimize superconducting phase. And for a good sample, this is about 25 Kelvin. On the other hand, if you go with, say, nickel, with about 3 to 4% of doping, this phase diagram will be pushed to your left, so spin density wave disappears much faster with nickel with two extra electrons, and then TC is more or less about comparable to the case of cobalt. Now, one big difference, perhaps, with high-TC cuplate is we dope by like 14% of cobalt atoms in this case. You can drive the system into non-superconducting, but nonetheless metallic system on this side. So one way of looking at it is, first of all, in undoped sample, it's not a mocked insulator. It's spin density wave semi-metal system. I'll come back to the point later on. And also, if you go to the overdoped site, as I'll show you later on, this looks like a more or less typical thermoliquid-like system. But there's one fundamental difference between the superconducting regime and overdoped regime. That is, in the superconducting phase, in the Brillouin zone, you have both hole band and electron band shown by green dots here by APES experiments. But if you keep doping and go into the overdoped metallic side, then you lose this whole pocket. So one issue people have been trying to address is, what's a mechanism behind superconductivity in relation to the disappearance of this hole band? So our goal was to investigate this whole phase diagram based on NMR, and it turns out that, in the past, in the case of cuplates, our typical thinking since 1980s was we start from a molten insulator and then destroy antiferrous state by a few percent of hole doping, and then drive into superconducting phase, and then try to understand starting from the left-hand side of this phase diagram. But in the present case, we can really start from the right-hand side. We start from metallic phase, and then reducing the doping concentration, and then we generate the hole band in the middle of the Brillouin zone, and then superconductivity kicks in. So that's the kind of way of thinking we prefer to take, so that's what I'm going to explore in my talk. So this is a typical resistivity data for cobalt-doped system. So in undoped case, this is the semi-metallic resistivity, and then here is a first-order spin density wave transition. And once spin fluctuation dies out, this is more or less T squared. If you go to the extreme opposite limit, so if you go to like 26% doping, so this is non-superconducting metal, and then as you can see, this is roughly T squared. And in between is a superconducting phase, like 8% doping here, and it turns out that this region is roughly T linear. So that's reminiscent of what we saw in high tissue cube plates since 1980s. So there are several questions. One is, what is this T-linear behavior, which we tried to understand over the past 20 years in the context of Q-plate and multi-insulators? And also, if this is dominated by spin fluctuations, and in fact it is, then what is our relation to superconductivity? On the other hand, for instance, in Jehovah dope side, it is really thermal liquid, and actually we can test that idea with an amount, and it seems that this is really like thermal liquid. And also, if we change the film surface geometry, what's going to happen to the spin fluctuations and superconductivity? And I'll show you there's a clear correlation between the evolution of spin fluctuations and superconductivity. So what do we do? So NMR is a local microscopic probe. So one advantage we can have is by observing arsenic nuclear spins, we see locally what's happening in the lattice of ion scalars. So arsenic sits in the middle of iron plaquette, actually about a few angstroms above or below this plaquette. So we are seeing nuclear spin of arsenic site. So here, a slightly overdoped 9%, we see clearly two sets of NMR signals. And if you keep increasing, this intensity increases, and also we begin to see additional peaks. So we did a systematic measurement, and of course, in undoped sample, this peak disappears. So we could identify this as the arsenic, what we call arsenic 1 nuclear spin site, which is located in this geometry. So there's one nearest neighbor cobalt site. So by identifying all these atoms, we see, so this is the arsenic 0 peak, which means there's no nearest neighbor cobalt site. So we can do NMR at arsenic 0 or arsenic 1, or we can also do cobalt NMR to see locally what cobalt atom is doing. But in my talk today, because of time constraint, I'm going to focus on arsenic 0 NMR from this main peak. In a nutshell, arsenic 1 site tells us more or less the same information as the arsenic 0 site, so it's not particularly exciting. So let's focus on this arsenic 0 single peak. And this peak position is shifted from what you'd expect if there was no hyperfine interaction, and this frequency shift, field shift is called night shift. And this night shift is essentially a spin susceptibility, uniform component of spin susceptibility. But we are probing it using local probe. So this is actually important because in ion systems, no matter how clean the samples are, usually you end up having some ferromagnetic impurity phase because of ion. So it turns out that determining the intrinsic behavior of spin susceptibility is already very difficult. So using NMR night shift, we were able to deduce the intrinsic temperature and concentration dependence of spin susceptibility. So here's one example for cobalt doped system. So the key feature here is spin susceptibility in SDW order sample or even in superconducting sample or overdoped film liquid-like system, they all show roughly linear decrease, and then eventually they tend to level off. It doesn't vary whether you have spin density wave ground state or superconducting state of a molecular ground state. So whatever the mechanism is, something is suppressing uniform spin susceptibility. One naive picture is, of course, you have a short-range spin correlation, anti-ferro correlation, and because of that, uniform component is suppressed. Or maybe whatever the reason, there is some kind of excitation gap, and then a spin component is overall suppressed. But the important thing to emphasize is it always levels off. And it turns out that's a generic feature for all ion systems. So superconductivity sets in after susceptibility decreases and levels off. And it is in this region resistivity is also T-linear. Another thing we can do is to investigate low energy spin excitations or low frequency spin fluctuations. So what we do is we excite nuclear spins to high energy state by irradiating the sample by radio frequency pulses, and then observe the relaxation of this excited state back into the ground state. So this energy quanta has to be absorbed by somebody else, and in our case, usually it's conduction electrons in metallic systems, Or it may be parametric spin fluctuations or magnons in the ordered state. And if you have, say, energy gap in excitation spectrum, then you have hard time to recover to the original ground state, so the excitation rate becomes very small. Now, theoretically, NMR relaxation rate 1 over T1 divided by temperature is related to Q summation of imaginary part of dynamical spin susceptibility. Q is wave vector, averaged, integrated over blue Lewis zone, and F is NMR frequency, in our case, about 60 megahertz. So by measuring the temperature dependence of this, we are investigating essentially weighted Q average of spin fluctuation susceptibility at low energies. Oops. Okay, so let's start from the overdoped side. So there's nothing exciting in the phase diagram. It's just metallic. So as I showed you early on, spin susceptibility shown by red mark at the same data as the previous one, it decreases and more or less levels off. And I remind you, there's no hole band in the middle of the blue Lewis zone, so we have only intraband excitations in this case, I mean between electron bands. Now, it turns out that NMR relaxation rate divided by temperature also decreases and then roughly levels off. So qualitatively, both spin excitations and uniform susceptibility show similar temperature dependence. So that reminds us of the so-called Kohlinger behavior. That is, if you have simple flame liquid electrons, then night shift is proportional to power spin susceptibility, which is proportional to density of state of electrons at the Fermi energy, while NMR relaxation rate divided by temperature is supposed to be proportional to density of state squared. So if you compare these two measurements, night shift and NMR relaxation rate 1 over T1T, we can test whether the system is Fermi liquid or not. Now, it turns out that, so what I'm showing here is 1 over T1T square root versus night shift, using blue dots, and they are indeed satisfying this Kohlinger relation if we assume that chemical shift, basically this is a background component, a contribution to NMR night shift, is about 0.14%. So certainly, in agreement with T squared-like behavior resistivity, NMR relaxation rate and night shift also support the idea that overdoped regime is essentially more or less boring from liquid. However, I have to caution that it turns out that 1 over T1T also correlates very well with night shift itself. So we can't entirely rule out the possibility that this is just a Kohlinger-like behavior is an accident. We may have some kind of overdamped magnon as well. We can't really discern the two scenarios here. Okay, so I was talking about this overdoped non-superconducting sample so far. Let's see what happens if we begin to decrease from overdoped non-superconducting regime to lower concentration. So superconductivity sets in around 14% and optimized around 8%. And if you go to 7 or 6%, then you begin to have spin density wave ground state and 0% is spin density wave. So one obvious trend is, first of all, at higher temperatures, qualitatively, they all show the similar kind of temperature dependence. On the other hand, overall spin excitation gets bigger and bigger, and more importantly, once you go into the superconducting regime where the hole band begins to emerge in the middle of the Fermi blue Lewis zone, we begin to have up-down of the NMR relaxation rate, 1 over T1 divided by T. What this means is, remember that uniform susceptibility levels off after it decreases. So this cannot be associated with spin excitations near Q is equal to zero. And also, knowing that we begin to have interband excitations between hole band and electron band, we have to attribute this to spin excitations associated with interband excitations whose wave momentum transfer is about pi over a. And the more important thing is this enhancement due to this basically anti-ferrospin fluctuations associated with this nesting vector is quite strong in this optimum doped phase. But if you enhance spin fluctuations slightly more, you begin to have divergence of relaxation. Actually, this is really blowing up. And so you end up having a spin density wave ground state. So superconductivity is optimized right around the time when you hit the boundary with spin density wave order. But so if it's too strong, spin fluctuation too strong, then you can't have superconductivity optimized. But on the other hand, if spin fluctuation is too weak, you end up having boiling film liquid. So what we did here, shown by our solid lines, this relaxation light spin excitation spectrum fitted into two components. So this term represents basically this background like a decrease, and delta happens to be around 400 Kelvin. So that we actually fixed this so we can vary this as a free parameter. But either way, we can represent this uptime using Curie-Weiss component so we can determine this Weiss temperature. So here is a summary. So we started from 26% and pushed into toward the boundary of spin density wave. So what I'm showing here is NMR relaxation light 1 over T1T inverse at fixed temperature of 25 Kelvin. So this is basically what I'm showing is at 25 K, how enhancement of spin fluctuations takes place with decreasing cobalt concentration. And so in the overall non-superconducting regime, we don't have much interesting phenomenon here. But then once superconductivity sets in around this concentration, spin fluctuations at low temperature get enhanced and more enhanced. And just before this really diverges, optimum superconducting phase is observed. And also, Weiss temperature crosses from positive to negative, and superconductor SDW boundary is right around the time frame we hit theta is equal to zero. So we can certainly argue this may be related to quantum criticality here. So to summarize what I have been saying, superconductivity is optimized around this region right between SDW and film liquid like electrons. And this is a region where susceptibility decreases and levels off in this region, and then resistivity goes roughly T-linear, obviously associated with spin fluctuations as we detected by NMR. And then susceptibility goes roughly as 1 over T, and that's where superconductivity is optimized. So as far as this set of data is concerned, we have to say superconductivity has close relation with spin fluctuations and also magnetic long-range order. Somehow, some kind of interrelationship seems to exist. Before moving on, well, maybe I'll skip because of time constraint. This is the order state. Let's jump on to the superconducting ground state. So veterans of cuprates all know this kind of plot. So if we plot NMR relaxation light 1 over T1 as a function of temperature, T-linear behavior is at the same collinear behavior, so for film liquid. In this case, MGCNI3. So we have low tissue superconductivity here, and relaxation light gets enhanced. This is called Hebe-Swichter coherence peak, which was taken as evidence for validity of Bichet theory back in 1950s. And then because of the isotropic energy gap, NMR relaxation light decays as exponential like this. On the other hand, this is a very old data from my master's thesis in 1980s. This was actually the first evidence for D-wave pairing in YVCO. 1 over T1 goes roughly T cubed. So this, and also there's no Hebe-Swichter coherence peak. So this was interpreted as evidence for nodes in the energy gap. But now I want to call your attention that when we go to low temperatures, it's generally always, almost always true that NMR relaxation light is affected by junk effects. In this case, basically some sort of dilute spin in the lattice, and relaxation light bends over. So in the case of YVCO, temperature window between TC and where this junk effect becomes dominant was so wide, we could see very clear evidence for parallel-like behavior. But unfortunately, in the case of ion system, So here is the same kind of plot. One of T1 plotted as a function of temperature in log-log scale. Now, first of all, notice that there's no Hilbert-Schlichter coherence peak, although this is not necessarily evidence for like a line nodes, because in the present case, a lot of theorists have been talking about so-called S plus minus state. And it turns out that in that case, even though there's no line node in any Fermi surface, but we don't have to have coherence peak. Basically, plus sign and minus sign contribute to a coherence factor, and they cancel out. Now, so the next thing we want to look for is whether this is exponential or parallel. Now, unfortunately, we begin to see, whatever the reason, basically this is junk effect, so to speak. At lower temperatures, relaxation rate bends over. So at the intermediate temperature region, we certainly see parallel-like behavior. We can't really say definitively this is the parallel behavior similar to cube plates. Now, some brave people, mostly my compatriots in Japan, so they decide to bet their life on whether it's D-wave or S-wave. And I certainly don't feel comfortable making any definitive statement based on this kind of data, because after all, it may be just that this junk effect is already affecting in this intermediate temperature range. Then exponential, much faster drop may be basically hidden for that reason. So it's somewhat difficult for us to say anything definitively. So we are in the process of attempting to improve the sample quality. My collaborators are trying very hard. And also we are trying to see if there's any correlation between this kind of low temperature, T-linear-like behavior on a specific heat measurement. So we have still some way to go to have a better idea about the superconducting ground state. Now, in the last few minutes, I want to touch a little bit about iron selenide. So this is a collaboration with Bob Carver's group in Princeton. So this is the simple structure ion scale lattice you have, and then each ion is surrounded by four selenide atoms instead of arsenic atoms. And it turns out that this system is very, very sensitive to defect, and you need to control this stoichiometry to really close to one. Otherwise, basically, you screw the sample. And the interesting thing is, this is not even an arsenic system, but genetic features are quite similar. For instance, resistivity is roughly T-linear before you go into superconducting state. And also, Tc is quite low as about 9 Kelvin, but if you apply pressure, Tc can be cranked up to almost 40 Kelvin. So this is also still a part of a high Tc family. So several questions we asked ourselves before embarking on this project was, is this system fundamentally different from iron arsenide? Actually, we didn't know this high Tc driven by pressure when we started this experiment yet. But it turns out that we don't really see any fundamental difference in NMR results. And also, we found the spin fluctuations also enhanced near Tc. And it turns out that when you drive the sample into high Tc regime by applying pressure, spin fluctuations are actually enhanced. Well, let's skip this. So this is, first of all, uniform spin susceptibility measured using selenium night shift measurement. So again, in analogy, very similar to cobalt-doped 1-2, susceptibility roughly linearly decreases and then almost levels off. So it doesn't keep going, it levels off. And it is in this temperature region where resistivity, susceptibility roughly levels off, that's where resistivity goes T-linear. And remember, in the case of 1-2, we saw enhancement of anti-ferrospin fluctuations in this region. So let's see how it goes. So here is a test of the presence of anti-ferrospin fluctuations in 1-1 phase. Now, it turns out that, again, NMR relaxation rate decreases, and then below this temperature region, toward Tc, spin fluctuations get bigger and bigger and bigger. So this is the ambient pressure. If you have slight off stoichiometry, and this is non-superconducting sample, then we don't have any enhancement of spin fluctuations. An equally interesting fact is if we drive the system into high Tc phase by applying pressure, spin fluctuations get enhanced. So it seems to me that we are moving from a slightly overdoped kind of state situation to optimum region by applying pressure, and spin fluctuation gets stronger, and then Tc gets higher. And also, I didn't bring the bigraph, but why is temperature, if we do the similar analysis like this, theta is almost zero when we go to 0.7 GPA with TC about 20 Kelvin. How about, let's see. I accidentally skipped one slide. Oh no, I didn't. Now, one complication is when we apply pressure, we see evidence for some sort of spin freezing or phase separation, we can't tell. But if we go to a higher pressure, TC goes up, but we begin to see evidence for some kind of spin freezing. So there is certainly proximity with the magnetic ground state. And here's the last slide. In the superconducting phase, so this is the, again, ANDOP sample, NMR relaxation like goes roughly T-linear, like cooling like behavior. But with ambient pressure, TC is roughly 9K. Again, there's no coherence peak, and it goes roughly TQ, roughly parallel like behavior, which may or may not be evidence for a line node, the case of a cobalt dope system. With applying pressure, again, relaxation rate gets enhanced, or spin fluctuation gets enhanced, and that results in enhancement of TC. But if we go to too high a pressure, then we begin to have spin freezing around these temperatures. So by and large, 1-1 system and 1-2-2 system are very similar. So it was a little bit of a rush, but this is a summary. Thank you for your attention.